Greetings to all who come upon this recording, either now, sometime in the year 2012, or in the near or distant future. This is John Lash recording this talk on October 4th, 2012, from Andalusia in Spain. The objective of this talk is to introduce you to the Guyan Navigation Experiment, or GNE. Initially, I'm posting this talk on my website, metahistory.org. You will find on the homepage of that site a link to another website, gaiaspora.org, which is actually dedicated to teaching and developing the GNE. Now, I don't intend this introduction to be a long, drawn-out presentation, nor do I wish it to be too short. So, I will do my best to compress into this talk all of the essential features that can be helpful to you to realize what is the Guyan Navigation Experiment and how unique it is, and how significant is the objective of this experiment for the human species, and not only humanity, but for all of sentient life on Earth, and for the life of the planet itself. I might begin by saying a little bit about myself, in case you don't know too much about me as you come upon this recording. I am principally known as the author of several books, the most recent of which is Not in His Image, published in the United States in November of 2006. I've also been developing for a number of years the website metahistory.org. And on that website, there is the equivalent of about 22 books. As you will see from the menu panel on the homepage, there are 13 categories of metahistory.org, plus a link via a banner to another site within that site, and that is the site that deals with planetary tantra. So there's a massive amount of material on MetaHistory.org, but it doesn't really matter if you know about it or if you've looked into it so far. It's not necessary for you to understand what I'm going to say in this talk. I would just point out that I have become known through my books, through my website, and through numerous talks and lectures that I've given, which are posted in various places on the internet, as a teacher. I would like to be known as a teacher. That is what I consider my primary role. I don't teach in a classroom or a university auditorium. I use the internet and my books and website to teach to the public at large, or at least to that self-selecting group of people who are attracted by what I have to say. What do I teach? Well, I am a teacher of comparative mythology and the critique of belief systems. All of this you will find explained in the guidelines section of metahistory.org. And on the homepage, you will see the mission statement for that site. I'm also known for being a kind of Gnostic scholar, though I don't have degrees, I don't have any academic qualifications. And I am not an expert in ancient languages such as Greek and Coptic. I have become known for my views on the question of, on the topic, I should say, of Gnosticism and the ancient mysteries or mystery schools of the pagan pre-Christian world. And so you will find on the homepage of metahistory.org, in the right-hand column under the logo, which is a tree and well, you will find a link to the Nag Hammadi reading plan. And this is an incomplete book consisting of a number of long commentaries on writings in the Nag Hammadi library, as it is called. That is a collection of writings in Coptic discovered in Egypt in 1945. And this collection presents a unique opportunity to learn some things about the ancient mystery schools, their practices, their views, and about who the Gnostics really were and what they taught. So I am, in some respect, a neo-Gnostic or Gnostic revivalist, and I am known for that aspect of my work, which has involved the most densely and intensely demanding scholarship of my life. At the same time, I differ from other scholars in that I transparently state that I am an experimental mystic, that I have experimented with shamanism in various forms, including the use of psychoactive plants or sacred teacher plants, which are not to be confused with drugs or laboratory-produced chemicals for altering the human mind. I am a strong advocate of telestic shamanism, as I call it, and there is a section on metahistory.org entitled Psychonautics, where you can investigate some of my views on that matter. So that's a brief introduction to myself. What's important about it, really, in regard to the Gaia navigation experiment, what's relevant, I should say, is that it points in the direction that life led me when I came to propose the Gaian navigation experiment. It points to where life led me. What I'm saying is that my studies, my research, my autodidactic scholarship, and my recondite understanding of ancient matters, such as it is, was never something merely abstract and was never something that I did in order to build up some image of self-importance as a person who knows more than others. For me, the purpose of exploring these matters was always part of my personal spiritual quest, if you will, if I may use that cliche. And as an experimental mystic and a comparative mythologist who has been linked to Joseph Campbell and Mircea Eliade, I was always pushing the envelope beyond the framework, beyond the received framework of mythology. And I was correlating my own personal mystical experiences to the material of mythology and ancient studies, and particularly the fascinating, deep and fascinating subject of the mysteries. That's about all that I would care to say about myself in this introduction. But I'll conclude by adding that if you understand where I'm coming from and what kind of scholar I have been, and if you can get some sense of what I mean when I talk about experimental mysticism, which, by the way, is a practice that is both independent of the use of psychoactive plants and relies on the use, so it can be pursued in both those ways. If you get the gist of that, it will be helpful to receive what I'm going to say now. It will be helpful because you will have the basis to understand that I did not invent the Gaian navigation experiment. Like an intentional program that I put together with my mind based on the things I've learned in my life. No, I didn't invent it. In a way, it invented itself. Or you could say, if you want to push it a little further, that it was the imagination of the human animal itself that invented the Gaian navigation experiment. And so I ask you to hold your judgment carefully in balance when you consider how I describe this experiment, its principles, its practices, and how you might become involved in it. And understand that I'm not pitching anything to anybody. I'm not pitching a program I invented. I am inviting you to participate in something that I discovered in the human imagination itself. And what makes this discovery so powerful, many things can be discovered in the human imagination. An artist, whether it be a singer, a painter, a dancer, a novelist, an artist is a creature who discovers and draws from human imagination, of course. But what is unique about this experiment is that it concerns that part of the power of human imagination that engages us to Sophia's dreaming. That is to say, it engages us to the conscience, sentient intelligence of the earth itself, of this planet, Gaia. And so when I speak of the divine power of imagination in humanity, bear in mind that I always connect it to its ground, which is the very ground you're standing on right now. And the ground of divine imagination is, in fact, the imagination of the planetary animal mother herself. She can be called PAM, if you want to take the initial letters of planetary animal mother. And those of us in the experiment affectionately like to call her PAM. The Gnostics in the mystery schools called her Sophia. This is the Greek word for wisdom. And of the many things that could be said about the teaching of the mystery schools, the most important thing you need to know to follow what I'm going to say now is that the Gnostics of the mystery schools, who were experimental mystics themselves, understood that Sophia is a being of a divine nature, a goddess or an aeon, whose existence precedes the existence of the planet in which she is now embodied. And so the central centerpiece and supremely sacred content of the mysteries was about Sophia and about her adventure in the universe, which is also the story of the origin of the human race, the origin of the earth, and the origin of those archontic or alien powers that prey on the human mind, and many, many, many other things. The Sophianic vision story, as I call it, is the background and grounding framework of the Gaian navigation experiment. So if you find that you are attracted to this experiment upon listening to this talk in its entirety, I strongly propose that you go and investigate the Sophianic vision story. You can find it described in 9 episodes on metahistory.org, and you can also find it described with extensive commentary in my book, Not in His Image. So with all that said, I would like to give you some background about the Gaian navigation experiment that you might find fascinating. Why do I presume that you might find it fascinating? Because it shows one of the things about life that is very fascinating. I would put it in this way. Through my life, I've come to understand that I had experiences at some moment in my adolescence, or they started actually when I was at the age of 4. And through these experiences, although I knew nothing of it at the time, the seeds of future experiences were being planted in my soul, as it were. Those seeds were planted, they nurtured. Over time, sometimes they were hidden for many, many years. And throughout my life, various events have occurred which were not fully revealed to me at the time. The significance of them was not fully revealed. But at a later time, the significance exploded and was spectacularly revealed. This is exactly what happened with the Gaia Navigation Experiment, which I proposed in June of 2011. So let me take you back to a former time, if I may, and show you how the seeds of this fantastic proposition were planted. Let me describe what physicists in the genre of chaos theory or complexity theory call the sensitivity of the initial conditions. Go back to the year 1972. In that year, in March of that year, the scientists of NASA and Cape Canaveral, or Cape Kennedy, as it's called as well, and their colleagues at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, engaged in a tremendous and novel and daring project, which was called Pioneer 10. Pioneer 10 was a robotic space probe of a unique kind. Its purpose was to do something that no other space probe had ever achieved, and that was to reach escape velocity that would take it out of the solar system. And the way that they did that was extremely clever. The scientists who programmed this vehicle, Pioneer 10, set up its trajectory along an interplanetary route. And they did so in such a way that when Pioneer 10 was launched from the Earth on a rocket, in the typical manner that satellites are launched, it was directed out beyond the orbit of the Earth, past Mars, toward Jupiter. And it was put on a trajectory such that it would be pulled into the gravitational field of Jupiter, which is immense, at a certain moment, but not pulled down to the planet itself. What the NASA and JPL scientists were looking for was a slingshot effect. They sent the Pioneer 10 out into proximity to Jupiter. It made a very close pass, and then they used the momentum of the dynamic celestial dynamics of Jupiter, including its gravitational system, to throw the probe onto the next planet, which was Saturn. And then when it reached Saturn, they used the celestial mechanical forces of Saturn to propel it on again beyond Saturn, out to Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and eventually out to the outer reaches of the solar system. They had never been able to achieve this kind of interplanetary trajectory before. And so Pioneer 10 was the first robotic space probe to achieve escape velocity from the Earth. One of the key moments in the voyage of Pioneer 10 happened on my birthday, actually, December 3rd, 1973. That's not the year that I was born, but the day. And at that time, in December 1973, just about 18 months into its journey, Pioneer 10 made its closest pass to the planet Jupiter. At that time, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with my girlfriend, Kathy. And we were living not far from the plaza in Santa Fe and having a pretty good time in our lives at that moment. And yet, I was compelled to leave that lovely woman in that situation to go to LA and do some research. And so I remember very well what was happening around my birthday in 73 when Pioneer 10 made a close pass to Jupiter, quite an historic moment in the annals of astronomy. And it certainly was a decisive moment in my own personal life because I left for LA the following spring. I arrived around Easter in Hollywood. And at that time, I immediately became immersed in a series of studies which eventually led me to come in contact with some of the JPL technicians who were managing the Pioneer 10 probe. And the reason for that was because in those years in LA, beginning in 74, 75, and 76, I was deeply involved in study of the planetary movements and planetary cycles of our solar system. And I was also practicing my idiocentric form of astrology. I made a living practicing astrology at that time, although I was not a conventional astrologer because I never insisted on the theory of planetary causation. That is to say, I never pretended that the planets or the positions of the planets relative to the place of birth at the moment of birth actually cause and affect the behavior and character of people. I never made that claim, nor did I ever use astrology to predict. And I also developed my own anomalous type of astrology. I converted the horoscope, I converted the symbols of the 12 signs and changed them. I converted the symbols of the planets, and I used both the tropical and star-based forms of astrology. You can read about this in the Sky Lore section of metahistory.org, or you can look at my book, Quest for the Zodiac, which describes my breakthroughs, my struggles and breakthroughs in the realm of, in the problematic realm of astrology. In any case, to cut to the chase, I was also an unusual astrologer, if I must say so myself, in that I took a deep interest in astronomy. Now, most astrologers don't know anything about astronomy and they don't care. But I was equally, or if not more, interested in astronomy at that time. And I wanted to understand the interactions of the movements of the various planets, and including the Earth itself and the Moon. By the way, one of the innovations of my astrological practice was that I included the Earth in the horoscope and gave the Earth a meaning, whereas all other systems of astrology, to my knowledge, and certainly at that date, categorically exclude the Earth, which is arguably the most important planet. If any planet influences you at all, it's going to be the Earth, isn't it? So I was looking intensely into precession, into the fact of the obliquity of the ecliptic, nutation, the lunar node cycles, and so forth, in order to develop, as far as I could, an intimate and accurate understanding of the celestial dynamics as they bear upon our home planet. Now, during that time, I lived in a small apartment in the Hollywood Hills, just up the street from the Yamashiro Japanese Pavilion. And I had no television, and I didn't follow the media or listen to radio, so I didn't really know that much about the Pioneer 10 project. But I was destined to converge with that project in a most remarkable way, and in turn, what I learned from a technician directing that project ultimately led me to the Gaia Navigation Experiment. Some of you may recall the Pioneer 10 mission without knowing the exact details of it. One aspect of the Pioneer 10 mission, I believe, has been deeply impressed upon the minds of many, many millions of people around the world due to the plaque that was attached to that space probe. As you may know, there was a plaque designed, I believe, by Carl Sagan, who was a kind of pop guru in the 70s with his series Cosmos. And this plaque shows two naked figures, two human animals standing side by side, along with various diagrams, simple and elegant diagrams, which are encoded with information about the Earth. So the thinking of the Pioneer 10 team was like this. We're going to use the slingshot method of passing this probe through in close proximity to the outer planets, Jupiter and Saturn, so that it is plunged by a slingshot effect into the outer reaches of the solar system. And eventually, we will lose track of this object, but the momentum will carry it beyond the solar system, beyond Pluto, which is formally defined as the limit of the solar system. And just in case someone else is out there and they happen to see it, they might observe this plaque, and that would convey to them information on the origins of this probe and some basic and essential information about the planet, where it originated, and the location of that planet as being third from the sun in the solar system. So that's a very imaginative and almost like an Arthur C. Clarke kind of theme here, you know, in this famous Pioneer plaque, which you can find, of course, by an image search on the internet. So the attention of the world, in a certain respect, was drawn strongly to the Pioneer 10 mission. And in addition to that, I would say, as a mythologist and someone who studies the structures and functions of the collective conscience, the collective unconscious, I would say that the Pioneer 10 carried a very special significance for humanity, because in a way it was a signal that announced our identity to the cosmos at large. Well, when we get around to the Gaia navigation experiment, we'll find that that is exactly what the Gaia navigation experiment does, but in a completely different manner. So to complete the background here regarding my studies and investigations in the 1970s in Los Angeles, let me point out where the rubber hit the road. I was in my little room above the Hollywood Hills, looking down on the streets of on Sunset Boulevard, Hollywood Boulevard, and I was using geocentric and heliocentric methods, which I was calculating, by the way, by hand. I had no computer at that time. This is 1974, 5, 6. I was looking down at the solar system using the format of a heliocentric or sun-centered and geocentric or earth-centered maps. And I was trying to get a picture of what the solar system looks like and how it actually works, and particularly how the various planets interact with each other, how they cyclically conjunct with each other. And as I was doing that, the reasons being I found that there, or I didn't find, but I speculated that there might be some patterns of historical significance that could be connected with the timing of the conjunctions of these planets. For instance, the planets Jupiter and Saturn conjunct every 20 years. So that creates a rhythm through time, a 20-year cycle. If you go and look at the historical events that occur concurrent with those conjunctions, do you find patterns? Likewise, for instance, the outermost planets of Uranus and Neptune conjunct one every 172 years. So there you have a longer range sine wave extrapolating through time. And if you go back at 172-year jumps, well, do you find anything particularly significant about those, the historical events happening at that moment? And is there some kind of pattern of interlinking historical events over that time frame? You see, I was deeply involved in investigating these questions, which were in turn related to my karmic and astrological investigations of the day. And by the way, just in case you might think I'm contradicting myself here, let me make something lucidly clear. I have said that I did not subscribe to the notion of planetary causation or planetary influence in my practice as an astrologer. That is true. I simply used astrology as a kind of symbolic, semantic system for diagnosis of emotional and psychological complexes and profiling human character. That's all. I used it as a symbolic code system. I did not assume planetary influences. Nor did I assume planetary influences when I was investigating cycles such as the Uranus-Neptune conjunctions that occur every 172 years. I didn't consider that those conjunctions would be causing historical events on Earth. I considered that they offered me a means to track patterns of events if such patterns did exist. And in that method, I hope you get the premise of what I'm saying here, in that methodology, which is called Aeonics, I followed the work of master astrologer Dane Rudjar, who was basically the creator of modern psychological astrology, Dane Rudjar. Now, we're at the 30-minute mark on this introduction, and I said I was coming to the point where the rubber hits the road. What I mean by this is, there was a remarkable incident that happened due to the fact that I realized in my study of the planetary system that at that very moment, 72, 73, 74, 75, there was a remarkable, absolutely remarkable configuration taking place among the planets. Something that was completely unprecedented. Now, you would have to study the planetary cycles and patterns going back through long periods of time. And I went all the way back to at least 600 BC. I was very limited in what I could do at that time. As I said, I was doing all this without computers. I was calculating it by hand. But I was able to see that at the moment I was making my investigations in the mid-70s, something extraordinary was happening in the sky. A lineup of the planets, loosely speaking. A lineup. Not that they lined up in a straight line going from the Earth out, but that they lined up like runners in a relay race. You know how when there's a relay race and a runner comes around with a torch, and at a certain point on the track coming around the bend, there's another runner crouched. And the first runner, who is by now exhausted, hands off the torch to the second runner, who continues the race. Well, there was a relay race type event happening among the planets in the 1970s, and I caught it. And once I caught it, I realized the obvious, which until then I hadn't understood, was that it was that relay arrangement of the planets that allowed the JPL and Cape Canaveral NASA people to slingshot Pioneer 10 beyond the escape velocity of the Earth. So I discovered in my historical and karmic or astrological studies, whatever you want to call them, the actual physical conditions they required uniquely to send this probe out beyond the limits of the solar system. They could not have done it at any other time. This was the optimal time, the mid-70s. Well, that was pretty remarkable, and I was very excited about that. And I also noticed that this entire pattern, this relay race pattern of the planets, had a 12-year time frame. That is to say, it began in 1981, in August of 1981, when Jupiter and Saturn were conjunct in the constellation of the Virgin or Virgo, and they were conjunct just about in the throat of the figure of the Virgin, in the throat. This is in August 1981. And from that moment on, when Jupiter and Saturn were perfectly aligned as seen from the Earth, Jupiter began to advance because it moves faster, and then Saturn advanced behind it. And in the subsequent 12 years following that, leading up to 1993, Jupiter successively conjuncted Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Saturn successively conjuncted Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And finally, in 1993, Uranus and Neptune conjuncted each other. So there was a remarkable dance that lasted really over 12 years. And I spent a great deal of my time in that period studying that pattern, that dance of planetary conjunctions, which I called the 12-year pattern from 1981 to 1993. And I wrote extensively about it. And in fact, the first article that I ever had published in an astrology magazine or an esoteric magazine was published in the Dutch magazine Bres, B-R-E-S. And it was on the topic of this 12-year pattern in which I saw a renaissance or revival of the Romantic movement. So, I'm giving you this background because it's a pleasure to recount how this happened, and it's so rich and engaging, even now, for me to recall how all of this came about. I don't want to swamp you with too much astronomy. I know that when I talk astronomy, people often turn off or their eyes glaze over very rapidly. And for some reason, for one reason or another, it's a topic that some people find difficult to take on board. But let me say that at the risk of jeopardizing this introduction with astronomical material, let me say this. You don't have to grasp the technicalities of what I'm saying to get the overall picture. So don't trouble yourself if you don't grasp the technicalities. I'm telling you this to involve you in what led to the Gaia navigation experiment, to give you a sense of what led to it. And all you have to know is that I did follow these events and that the most technically advanced scientists on the planet were also following them at the same time. Now, one of those experts was a gentleman named Professor Miles Standish. And somehow, I don't know how I managed to do it, I got him on my telephone from my little apartment in Hollywood. He was working at JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena at that time. And he was affable and forthcoming with me. I'm sure he had a lot of other things on his mind. There he was, part of a team directing the most daring and far-reaching planetary probe that had ever been launched from the Earth. And he still found time to talk to me about some questions that I had regarding subtleties of the orbital period of the Earth. And one of the things that I asked Miles Standish was about these mysterious points called the apsides of the moon, the apogee and perigee of the moon. So when the moon orbits around the Earth, it does not orbit in a perfect circle, but rather in an ellipse. All the planetary orbits are ellipses, by the way, ovals. And at one point in this ellipse, the perigee, the moon is actually closer to the Earth. That's why it appears larger sometimes when you see it in the sky. It's near or in its perigee. At another point on its elliptical orbit, it's in its apogee when it appears further from the Earth. And at those moments, if you look up and see the moon, you can be struck by the fact that it is distinctly smaller. And so the differences in distance are considerable in astronomical terms than they are actually perceptible to direct observation without instruments. But I was interested in the motions of the apsides of the moon for some rather esoteric reasons I won't go into right now. But I was looking at the fine granular detail of how these points behave and how they rotate actually through the sky and repeat their positions approximately every 8.5 years. And so I called Miles Standish, a complete novice out of nowhere. I didn't tell him I was an astrologer, to ask about how we can track the rotations of the lunar apsides back into history. And he presented me with some remarkable papers, which he actually mailed to me, and I still have them this day. He went out and he copied these papers. Now, they were far beyond my comprehension. But in the conversation with him, he brought out a couple of points that stunned me at the time. First point was he said that this fluctuations in the near and far point of the moon in its orbit around the Earth are extremely subtle and complex, and that they involve a problem of science which no one has ever satisfactorily solved, which is called the three-body problem. Now, I learned later on that the three-body problem is connected with the origins of chaos or complexity theory. It was tackled by Henri Poincaré, who was a French astronomer or physicist, and it is an intimate topic to those scientists and mathematicians who are trying to understand chaos, which is to say the turbulent fragility of cosmic processes. And so that was my first taste of chaos theory, and Miles Standish explained to me that it would be quite difficult to know exactly and accurately where the lunar apogee and perigee were in the past. And at that time, of course, there was no computer-generated ephemeris that would serve that purpose. There is now. And so he really caught my attention, and I began to work out as best I could with the very limited means that I had. I am not a mathematician by any means, although I was gifted in mathematics when I was an adolescent. I try to work out what's going on with these lunar apsides, you see? And this was in 1974 and 1975. And now I'm going to jump ahead to the Gaian navigation experiment, because the position and behavior of the lunar apsides is an absolutely critical part of this experiment, so it turns out. But before I tell you how the Gaian navigation experiment exploded upon the world, even before it was designed as such, let me just say this. I had a deep intuition in 1975 after talking with Miles Standish that there was something immensely important about the apsides of the moon, the apogee and perigee points on the orbit of the moon. And it became not really an obsession for me, because I'm not an obsessive type, but it became a deep, deep point of interest and investigation. And I held on to it like a dog holding on to a bone. I never let go of it. And over many, many years, I continued to develop my understanding of this mechanism, as if I was holding on to it for some reason. But the other thing that's curious, some reason to be revealed in the future, but the other thing that's curious is, well, I didn't tell anyone else about it. Like, I just kept it to myself. And it's as if there was some voice in me saying, okay, John, just hang on. Keep your eye on the ball here. Keep your attention on this matter. But don't tell anyone about it, because the moment will come when you'll know that it has to be explained. And it was really odd. So that moment came in my life in the spring of 2011, just about in February or March, just before the Fukushima catastrophe. All of you will certainly remember that. In the month or so before the Fukushima catastrophe of 2011, guess what I did? I decided for the first time in my life to involve a few other people. There were five or six people interested at that time. We were all communicating through the internet. I decided to involve these people in what I knew about the lunar apsides, A-P-S-I-D-E-S, and about the importance of observing the moments when the moon was in these two points, which occur twice in every month. Now, I had been observing those moments for a very, very long time, all on my lonesome. In fact, if you count the years from 1975 to 2011, you have about 36 years. It was well over half my life when I was deeply engaged in what I will call the mystery or enigma of the lunar apsides. And finally, I thought, well, I think I'm going to get these people involved and we'll set up a little experiment and I'll tell them the moments each month. I'll give them a record of the moments each month when the moon stands in its apogee and when it stands in its perigee. And I'll also describe to them where exactly those points are located in the sky at those moments. And we'll set up a little experiment to observe those moments together and see if there's anything that we can observe. For instance, anything that we can observe in ourselves, psychic or emotional material that might come up at that moment. We are, after all, human animals who live in the environment of the living planet. We inhabit the environment of the living planet. So whatever the planet feels, we in some respect would feel. So I don't consider it to be far-fetched that we might respond to lunar phenomena. As a matter of fact, you all know the stories about the full moon, about the way it affects the human brain, about the way that it affects the cycles of the moon affect menstruation and many other phenomena in nature, as well as the effects of the full moon upon the human psyche, resulting in some cases in what used to be quaintly called lunacy. So now we are really looking at an influence of the planet, but it's not a planet. It's a satellite of our planet. So any influence that the moon has on human animals or any other creatures in nature is actually a reflex influence of the planet Earth through the moon upon those creatures. And so I was proposing, in what I consider to be a loosely, scientifically valid sense, that we simply observe if there would be any effects at these moments. And also we would observe outwardly if there would be anything happening in the outer world, in the events in the social world or in nature at large. It was just an experiment in moments of observation. This was in February and March of 2011. Now, lo and behold, something happened at that time which was similar to what happened to me in 1974 and 75 with the Pioneer Project. It so happened that there was an event taking place in the world at large that drew the attention of millions and millions of people around the world. And that event was intimately connected with what I was doing in my own private investigations. But I didn't know about that connection until the event happened. And what was that event? It was the supermoon of March 2011. The supermoon. Why is there a supermoon? Well, here you go. At that time, there were many reports on the internet and even on mainstream news about the supermoon. They said that there's going to be a full moon in March, the exact date being the 19th. And these reports, which went out massively across the planet, explained that the moon would look extremely large, dramatically, spectacularly so at that moment. And guess why? Because at that moment of that particular full moon, as sometimes occurs, the moon was in its perigee point. That is to say, the point of its orbit where it is closest to the Earth. So I was staggered to find out that within 6 weeks of introducing the subject of the lunar apsides to a handful of six people, countless millions of people around the world had that concept introduced into their minds. And this is how the Gaia navigation experiment kicked off. Now, I've taken a considerable amount of time here, 50 minutes, to give you the background of the experiment. I didn't know exactly how I would handle this when I started this introductory talk. I think it would be best if I present the talk to you in two parts. So I'm going to conclude part one here, and then I will follow up with a second talk, part two of the introduction, which goes into the actual substance and objectives of the Gaia navigation experiment itself. I'm pleased that I have been able to give you the background of this experiment in the preceding words, in my preceding words. It's the first time that I have ever publicly and at length explained the background of what I am currently doing now in the Gaian navigation experiment. And again, if you will not allow yourself to be blocked or put off by the astronomical references, you may be able, I'm sure you will be able, to follow the plot of the story, and that is the important thing. In this case, the plot of the story, the plot of the discovery process, is more important than the technical details of that process. Now, in concluding the first part of this introduction to the Gaian navigation experiment, I'd like to address a subject which may be floating around in your minds or may eventually float into your minds. And it is a subject of current discourse today, which is a very baffling and troublesome one on the one hand, but might also, in this context, serve as a portal of orientation toward the Gaian navigation experiment. What I refer to is the widely discussed topic in the alternative media of mind control, mass mind control. Now, many people have investigated this subject, and it has been shown to consist of a number of components. One of them is, of course, the CIA MK Ultra angle. No question about it, shadow government agencies have been experimenting with mind control for many decades now. And so you have the example of the Manchurian candidate and so forth. There's no question, for instance, that Sirhan Sirhan was a Manchurian candidate and a mind control subject. And other examples could be cited. Without going into the particulars, let's just consider this theme of mind control. What does the two words mind control suggest to you? Well, I don't know about you, but they suggest to me two things simultaneously. One is could my mind be under some kind of remote control? And second, could the collective mind of the human race be under some kind of sinister external control? This is a question worth asking. And as you contemplate that question, there's a natural tendency to extrapolate and to speculate. And so it's not easy to contemplate that question and remain focused and sober. But it's necessary and important to contemplate this question and to delve into the scary subject of mass mind control. Why does this relate, or how does this relate to the Gaian navigation experiment? Indeed, it relates to it in a most intimate manner, particularly in regard to the importance of the moon as one of the parameters for the practice of the GNE. Observation of the cycles of the moon is an essential practice of the GNE. What does the moon have to do with mind control? Well, some people, I don't have to name names, have suggested that the moon is actually not a naturally formed planetary body, but that it's an artificial satellite that was set in place by aliens who have a sinister agenda regarding humanity, and that correlative to this claim is the notion that the moon operates like a transmitting tower, as in the film They Live, a transmitting tower that sends out a signal that dumbs down and hypnotizes the masses. Now, I'm looking hard at the question of how life on Earth can be so crazy, so insane, and how things can be going so totally wrong with the herd of human animals. And I'm willing to accept that there could be some kind of mind control, and I definitely believe that there are forms of mind control through the media, through advertising, through music, through the entertainment. Propaganda is a form of mind control. Education is a form of mind control. But when it comes to the cosmic perspective, I am compelled to stand before you and absolutely refute the notion that the moon is an artificial satellite being used to transmit into the human mind thoughts and frequencies that control humanity and drive us into insane and destructive behavior. This notion is extremely unfortunate, and it's unfortunate for those who are propounding this notion as well as for those who buy into it. I consider it to be a particularly dangerous error that floats around in current investigations of the mind control question. Okay? Now, whether or not you subscribe to this notion of the alien moon matrix, I would like to propose to you a question, a choice, really. And I'm going to leave you with this choice to resonate in your mind before you listen to the second half of this introduction. Suppose that you are one of those people like myself who is intent upon delving into the problem of mind control, mass mind control on this planet. If, here is my question, if you are willing to devote your precious time and attention and intelligence to understanding how your mind could be controlled remotely by some alien force or by other human beings who are working in the manner of an alien force, would you also be willing to devote your time, attention, and intelligence to learn how your mind is coordinated, not controlled, how your mind is coordinated with the mind of the planet itself, the mind of Gaia? Now, consider that question for a moment. Perhaps it's never occurred to you that your intelligence is not an isolated phenomenon. Have you considered that your intelligence as a member of humanity, or the massive herd of human animals, as I prefer to say, that your intelligence, the intelligence of your brain and your body and your senses, belongs to a living matrix of intelligence that is grounded in the life and mind of the planet itself? Just like the intelligence of a single cell in your body, with its internal mechanisms of chromosomal functions, replication, RNA, ribosomes, production of ATP, and so forth. Just as all the functions in the cell of your body are integrated into the organism of your body, likewise, all the functions of your mind and body are integrated into the superorganism of the earth, which is alive and intelligent, sentient, self-aware, just like you. Now, what I am saying here, and listen up closely, I do not propose to you as an article of belief. I propose it to you as a proposition to be tested. But how would you test it? How would you test your ability to become conscious of the way that your intelligence is coordinated with the intelligence of the earth? Well, one thing you might do is take a look at the Gaia navigation experiment, because that is exactly what this experiment proposes, and that is one of the objectives of this experiment. Now, in my concluding remark, allow me to tell you exactly why the moon is such an important factor in the practice of the GNE. There is a branch of experimental science called biofeedback, and this is actually the outgrowth of something that was originally called autogenic technique, autogenic, which was initially defined in the early 1930s by a German psychiatrist. Now, what is biofeedback? Allow me to read the definition from my book, The Seeker's Handbook, published in 1991. Biofeedback: the process of monitoring bodily signals such as pulse, temperature, and brain waves in order to bring them under mental command and, by extension, use them to induce desired mental and emotional states. Widely used by Western practitioners to achieve mental and physical states of control comparable in some cases to the feats of Eastern yogis. Described by Barbara Brown, one of its main exponents, as, quote, voluntary control over reflex functions, end quote. As some of you probably know, biofeedback is routinely performed with an instrument that measures some bodily function. For instance, blood pressure. Suppose someone has high blood pressure. The biofeedback therapist sits them down with a machine, hooks them to the machine, which gives a constant readout of the blood pressure. And then the biofeedback or autogenic therapist guides that individual through a mental visualization, a meditation, there's a number of techniques, which allow the individual subject to see that he or she can actually modify the level of blood pressure by direct interaction, not with the biofeedback machine, but with the body itself. So the biofeedback machine is a device that monitors the interaction between mind and body and allows the subject to control that interaction for its own benefit. Just so, the moon is a biofeedback device attached to the earth in such a way that by observing the cycles of the moon, the rhythms of the moon, and particularly the points when it is close to and distant from the earth, we are actually able to monitor our own interactivity with the earth. The moon is not an artificial device that serves an alien purpose to manipulate and control human minds. It is, in fact, a magnificent part of the telluric or terrestrial matrix of the planet Earth. How could the moon be an artificial satellite when it is known that the cycles of the moon and the phases of the moon and its declination above and below the horizon and its appearance on the horizon, it correlates to thousands and thousands of natural events, such as the activity of coral in the sea, the behavior of plankton, the behavior of glowworms in the sea, countless examples of behavior in the insect kingdoms, in the animal kingdoms, among birds, and at the molecular level demonstrate that the moon, the body of the moon, is an intrinsic part of the total atmospheric matrix of the living planet. Undeniably. And so, that being the case, what purpose could it serve for the human animal, granted that the human animal appears to have special and exceptional faculties? Is there some way in which the moon, as a biofeedback or autogenic device provided by Gaia herself as part of her system, could be used by us to become conscious participants in her system? That is to say, not only conscious and timely observers of the life cycles of the earth, but deep participants in the purposes and designs and aims of Gaia Sophia, the living, intelligent Earth. So the next time you look at the moon, ask yourself those questions. Frame in your mind, in some paraphrase of your own, the questions that I've just proposed, and see how you feel about that. See if you would like to be involved in deep participation in the intelligence of the Earth through the cosmic instrumentality that the Earth itself provides for you. And I would leave you with that syntax as the portal to part two of my introduction to the Gaian Navigation Experiment. Thank you for your patience and your kind attention.